In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about the problem of deforestation, particularly of tropical forest in Latin America. And our guest has been working in this area following these issues for quite a long time. Our guest is Susanna Hecht. She is a professor in the School of Public Affairs at University of California, Los Angeles. She's also a former director of UCLA's Environment and Latin America program. She works in environmental studies with special emphasis on the role of development and globalization on the tropical ecosystems in Latin America. And she is here visiting the campus. Her visit is jointly sponsored by the folks at the Center for Global Studies, the Center for Advanced Studies, and also the Mega Disasters Research Group. She's going to give a talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum. And I'm sure that anyone who is interested should feel welcome to stop by and hear her talk, talking on the topic Globalization, Forest Trends, and Received Ideas, Rethinking Development and Conservation in the 21st Century. That's the title. And again, that's this afternoon at 4 o'clock. Here on the program, though, questions are welcome. We're really pleased that being here at the university, a lot of interesting people come and we can have them on the program and bring them and their ideas to a wider audience far beyond the boundaries here of Champaign-Urbana. So if that is the case for people who are listening and they would like to ask questions, they can certainly do that. That's very welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. At any point here, folks who can call in and join the conversation. Thanks very much for being here.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
It seems to me that this particular issue of tropical deforestation in the Americas, something that got a lot of attention, particularly, I guess, in the 1980s, and particularly when we're talking about rainforests, say, in Brazil. And there was a lot of concern about the rate at which forest was being cleared, the impact that that had on the global environment, and the impact that that had on the ecosystems of the region. And it seems that then I sort of feel like I don't hear as much about that now as I did, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. Can we talk a little bit generally about whether, in fact, this is still a serious problem?
Well, actually, I was sort of surprised to hear the mega diversity people are on this because, of course, it is sort of a mega diversity or mega disaster problem that's now going on in tropical Latin America and South America. But it's a complicated story. One of the reasons it's complicated is this, which is that the models used for understanding deforestation in the 1980s, and you're right, there hasn't been, it sort of fell off the map. Chico Mendes was martyred, extractive reserves came in, there were the triumphant Indians on their reservations, there was the Article 88 that valorized traditional lands, and then there was Rio 1992, and everyone vowed to save tropical forests. And then after that, everybody sort of dusted off their hands and, you know, went on to other things. Meantime, of course, the world didn't stop. One of the things that happened, of course, is that there were really major structural changes in global economies. You can think about the sort of rise of the Asiatic markets. You can think about the impact of what are called structural adjustment programs, which basically changed the way the state worked from being sort of oriented to itself and shifting over to working more with markets. You had a lot more, as I mentioned, free trade. You had administrative decentralization. And you had a real contraction in the state sector. Now, this all had a lot of implications because it meant that processes of globalization could really unflow. Now, what do we mean by globalization? Well, we mean basically the flow of capital, of labor, of financial goods, of commodities and ideas, and those then sort of interact with stuff on the ground and shape the economies in particular ways. Now, what happened in the 1990s was the emergence really in Brazil of the soybean economy. And although it had been sort of going along rapturously during the 1980s, most of that expansion, and it was huge, it was like 60 million hectares of open savanna in over 20 years, began to be converted into soybeans. What happened were that many of the soybeans geneticists and crop specialists, many of whom were, by the way, trained here in the American Midwest, many perhaps even in Illinois, I'm not sure, but Indiana and Iowa certainly had a role, basically creating a coterie of wonderful crop scientists of various kinds who took on the challenge of adapting soybeans to tropical rainforest conditions in soils that had really high levels of aluminum, which is toxic to a lot of plants, low levels of phosphorus, which the rhizobium, the thing that fixes nitrogen in the soybean needs, and to low levels of micronutrients that they also need. So basically what happened is these clever technicians and scientists resolved the problems, and the soybean economy began to explode into the Amazon. So right now, more than half of the soybeans that are sold by Brazil worldwide come from the Amazon, and also its animal herd, its beef herd, is now probably the largest in the world, with about 30 to 40 million animals grazing on improved pastures. So I think if we want to think about the dynamics of Amazonian change, it's not just an abstract thing about forest economies. It's also a story about the impact of global economies, which has implications even for Illinois.
Yeah. Well, we can talk about those two things maybe in separate categories. One is what happens when you say, what do you lose if you lose forest? The other could be, okay, what then if you turn that land into farmland and you're growing soybeans and you're raising livestock for cattle? Maybe that's another set of questions. When you look at I'm just interested in the rate of loss of forest. That was, say, between 1960 and 1990, that it was very, very high. And I guess my understanding is it continues to be high. Is forest being cleared at the rate that it was before?
It's increasing at an accelerating rate. What happens is that the rates are not always even. So it's not like a smooth curve going up. Mm-hmm. Also, there was a really severe El Nino event a couple of years ago, and there were just lots of fires all over the place. And even there were lightning fires, there were clearing fires, they got out of. So you had a really sharp deforestation spike a couple years ago, really sharp deforestation spike in 1996. Deforestation also depends on how well the economy is doing, whether people have money to invest in it. And so when you have sort of downturns in the economy, it goes down. But overall, the trend is an increasing one, and particularly since global markets for grains, particularly for soybeans and corn, have become relatively good, at least from the South American perspective, since they sell mainly to the European Union and supply about a third of Chinese imports of soybeans, which is a pretty that market is a pretty dynamic one. So the rate of deforestation has not dropped at all and is an increasing one. It depends on where you are on the rate. But we're looking at the loss now. The area that has been converted is, depending on who's having a fight with who this week, ranges between about 10 and 12% of the region has been cleared. And in places like Mato Grosso on the soybean frontier or on what's called the Arc of Fire, you're looking at about 1 million hectares a year of clearing. Hmm. That's a lot.
That's a lot. When you go back to the kinds of things that were being said when this was a big issue in the 80s, and I think that people who were concerned with the problem of deforestation, as they were trying to persuade people who, say, live in the United States, that that's something that they should be concerned about, the argument was that this is not just a local issue for the place where the rainforest is being cut down. We were being told that it's something that we should worry about because it has an impact on the environment of the entire globe.
Well, that's certainly the case, because when you take high biomass forest or even medium biomass forest, the forest that people might, or the sort of open savanna or open formations, dry forest formations that people might not necessarily think about when they think about tropical forest, those are forests are being converted at a really, really high rate, partly because they sort of lack the sacred grove narrative about what kind of forest they are. Mm-hmm. But they are very important in terms of global carbon storage. they are much more diverse than was previously thought. Partly the sort of deification, if I may say, of tropical rainforests, and they are really marvelous. I'm not being snide about them, but in a certain sense, they captured everyone's imagination so thoroughly that attention to the complexity was sort of other forest formations was sort of superseded by the glory of these tropical forests. But what you have is a really sharp dynamic of clearing of forests that are actually, in many ways, much rarer than most tropical forest formations. And these are these tropical deciduous forests, which have just been ravaged from one end of the continent to the other. So these forests, while maybe perhaps not as much to look at or not carrying suitable jungle boy credentials, I mean, you can ride a horse through these, you know, actually turn out to be highly diverse. They have very high degrees of endemism. But because they were kind of off the radar, in places like Brazil, they weren't even considered part of national patrimony. So it's the laws that work in places where you have forests as part of natural patrimony, where you have to save a certain proportion of your land holding in natural vegetation and so on, just simply don't apply. So for these particular types of forests, you could just bulldozer them to smithereens, burn them later, and everyone would say, well, it was kind of a useless forest and not that dramatic anyway, when it turns out 10,000 species, many, many endemics, and also extremely important in the dynamics of regional climate, and also as the Amazon, like many other areas, is kind of a key element in global climate. We're starting to see sort of perturbations now in Amazonian climates that are quite distressing, the recent drought there being one of them, and also a lot of conjecture about the impacts globally.
Mm. Well, I think also people have tried to make the argument for preserving places like this that you have touched on, that is, these are some of the places that in terms of their diversity of plant and animal species are some of the richest places on the earth, no question, and that it's worth preserving that diversity for in its own right. And if that's not a good enough argument for you, then there are marketable products that might be derived there. Of course, then maybe you get into some arguments about who gets to profit. But that if just preserving diversity for its own sake isn't good enough for you, then you can make the argument that they're valuable resources. Having said that, does that help making that argument that says, well, if you cut this forest down, it's like you're throwing away something that you and the people of your nation and the people of your region and ultimately maybe the people of the world can profit from?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways to approach that. And I think what we might want to do is think of it as sort of there's a whole level of things such as environmental services that are, you know, keeping the water clean, processing the water, generating oxygen, absorbing CO2, moderating climate, moderating hydrologies, that these ecosystem services, I think, were calculated to be equal to all the economic activity in all the economies of the world. And we get these for essentially the planet provides these for us. So things like the Kyoto Protocol, which were meant to think about ways that you could subsidize or pay for people to act as stewards for maintaining environmental services. In the case of the Kyoto, of course, it was for carbon storage. But also at local levels, people are increasingly looking at things like managing watersheds for water and irrigation and electricity and so on, and using that idea of services as things that you pay for rather than free goods provided by the environment. So it's important to realize that this idea of environmental services can be activated from the most local level to the most august planetary scale. What's interesting about it, though, is that communities increasingly, and particularly peasant communities that may not really be able to compete in global grain markets and so on, or for a number of reasons have a lot of livelihood activities linked to forests, are increasingly seeing environmental services as a way of sort of supporting inhabited forests and thinking about forest zones not as places you visit, but places that you live in, and that those then start to reshape perhaps how we might think about forest conservation, not in the kind of national park John Muir model of, you know, forest primeval, which it never was, by the way, but to think of forests as being both human habitat and human artifacts.
Let me introduce again our guest here, Professor Susanna Hecht. She's professor in the UCLA School of Public Affairs. She's also former director of UCLA's Environment and Latin America program and has been working in the humid tropics for a couple of decades now. She's here visiting the campus to give a talk about globalization, forest trends, and the ideas of development and conservation in the 21st century, and his good enough to come here, spend some time with us too, to talk about the same thing. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The forest that we're talking about is the kind of thing, it's enormous and it crosses a lot of national boundaries. So I guess would give you the opportunity to make some comparisons between how different countries essentially deal with managing the same resource. And it seems to be the case that in some places, the rate of loss of the resource is very high. And at others, they've actually been doing a little bit better in terms of preserving and managing it. And I wonder, can you talk a little, do a little contrast between places where you think that they're really doing well and other places where they're not?
Well, if we think about the sort of explosive frontier of the Amazonian Arc of Fire as one sort of outcome of globalization, you can also think about Central America's returning forests as sort of another consequence of globalization, but one that's quite under-recognized. One of the things that I think gets overlooked a lot is that there's also a lot of forest there's a lot of deforestation. But in many places, there's a lot of forest recovery. And those places are unusual in a number. Sometimes it's just people can't make a go of it in tropical frontiers and abandon their land. Sometimes, you don't have enough money to make investments, or it's a speculative deal that falls through, or there's a number of reasons. There's also the impact of wars. For example, in Colombia, where you have a million displaced internal refugees, basically people have fled the countryside because it's too insecure. So in those places, what's happened is that the agricultural frontier has kind of stopped in its tracks. In Central America, you had the situation where you had, during the 1980s, a lot of civil wars. You had them in Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua. And these actually ended up halting the agricultural frontier. What happened was simply that you would either be massacred or by one group or another, it became too complicated. So people fled rural areas and forests came back. Also, forests were, if you will, the mantle of the FMLN. It was the mantle of the rebels. And so they were interested in keeping forests going. And also in this process, which was extremely difficult and extremely violent, many, many people embarked on the journey to the United States. In a country like El Salvador, about one-sixth of the population, because the internal violence was so severe, fled to the United States. Well, the result of this is that they got jobs, got lives, and so on, but their relatives continued in these areas. So what happened is that over time, what you had was essentially they sent money back, and the rural families might have been sort of in a kind of peri-urban environment, that is kind of a suburban or other kind of environment, basically began to live on the remittances rather than agriculture. So this is another thing that contributed to the emergence of a lot of forest resurgence in places like El Salvador. El Salvador, of course, during the late 1970s and early 80s, was sort of the Malthusian poster child for population density and natural resource destruction. But right now, it's an area where, because of the impacts of remittances, structural change in the economy, and cheap food policies, part of the structural adjustment programs, meant that basically the costs of producing agricultural commodities much higher than the cost that you receive for them. So essentially, people have retracted from agriculture, and there's been this big structural change in the economy, largely supported, it has to be said, by remittances from the U.S.
So it sounds as if when you look at those places where there's some resurgence of forest, that it's not necessarily that someone is making a deliberate effort to do the restoration. It's just that for one reason or another, they've stopped what they were doing before and just let it alone.
Well, that's exactly right. And remember, Central America is an area ecologically that's been densely inhabited for several millennia. This is the area of the Maya, the Olmec. It's, the place is rife with actually fabulous ruins, and it's worth going to look at these and to contemplate these forested areas and their enormous civilizations. The other thing is that it's also an area that gets earthquakes all the time. The place is rife with volcanoes. It gets smacked by hurricanes. And the soils are good because they're volcanic soils. So if you're going to think about a place that where you could have sort of dynamic vegetational resurgence, you know, Central America is the place. And even in spite of this sort of dire history, because really at the end of the 1970s, El Salvador was mostly deforested. Now it has it's about 2 million hectares or about 5 million acres in size, so small country. But it has a bird diversity of about 380 species, which is about the size of most of the United States in terms of its diversity. More than 2,000 plants, 150 different mammals and amphibians and so on. I don't actually have the numbers right in front of me. But in any case, what you have is a really important resurgence of wildlife, a lot more diversity in this area, in spite of the fact that its population density is really high. It's about 200 people per kilometer squared, about 200 people per 2.5 acres, or 250 acres, excuse me. So it's one of these places which has a high population density, a rich forest recovery, and a lot of biotic diversity that's coming back. Now, the problem with El Salvador is that everybody, if I may quote the great ecologist John Terborg, El Salvador, where nature has been extinguished. Well, no, it actually hasn't been extinguished. And if you think of inhabited landscapes as having a possibility of really contributing to a biodiversity, climate modification, and so on, then if you want to think about conservation, you can keep going with these muirist models, these set-asides. There's nothing wrong with that. But you have to also begin to really think about inhabited landscapes as important sites. And you're exactly right, David. The thing is, these places are what we might call policy orphans. Essentially, who's been funding the resurgence of these is these migrants who are sending back that $100 a month to maintain environmental services for the entire world.
We have a caller here, and we'd certainly welcome others. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Caller is here in Champaign County, where we are, and it's line number one. Hello.
Hi. There's a limit to how much export of people, which is basically what relying on remittances is, as opposed to having an economy that actually is supplying needs for people. And since we're dumping the corn in, obviously they can't just grow corn. So makes one think of the, and there are some of these going on. I wanted you to comment about the extractive reserves movement. And it doesn't sound so good in English. I think maybe it sounds better in Spanish because actually you start with the idea of it being a reserve. But this is a way that people can live and get wealth out of the fecundity of the forest without burning it and growing cows. It seems to me that it also requires, though, a different kind of ownership structure. The ejido system in Mexico, and that's true through a lot of indigenous areas, is entirely appropriate for this common use, common property kind of thing. And it's not IMF policy, that's for sure, and it's kind of alien to policymakers here, it seems. But I think it's making some headway in some places, perhaps Costa Rica or... Can you speak to that issue?
Sure, I'd love to. Actually, you raise a lot of really good points. You're right that, of course, there is a limit to what you can do in terms of remittances, but Certainly, one of the things you want to think about globally, I think, is that remittances from all over the world, basically, if you added them all together, from, you know, Sri Lankans working in Dubai and Filipinas working in Los Angeles, you know, that kind of thing, that's the world of remittances is about 20, it would make it the 25th largest economy on the planet. So it's a significant amount of money that's flowing around, and it has kind of the advantage of that it goes directly to the people rather than going through a often very corrupt state structure, which would love to get its mitts on these, you know, really billions of dollars. So you're right about that. But on the other hand, we do seem to, one of the features of globalization is a very mobile international labor force at all scales, from the most, you know, fancy CEOs and high-tech producers, to the most humble agricultural worker. So it's one of the features of globalization that you also have these really mobile labor forces, and that's just one of the things we are dealing with. But in terms of extractive reserves, you're absolutely right. There are these issues of non-timber forest products that have been rather interesting. And, of course, one of the most interesting of the commercial production systems in Central America has been what's been its defining commodity in a lot of ways, which is coffee. And this, a lot of coffee is grown under diverse canopies and so on. It's, you're absolutely right, it's often under very complex tenurial regimes. And it's interesting that you raise this question, because in El Salvador, for example, in areas where you're seeing most of the forest resurgence, is not where you have sort of simple private property regimes, but where you have a really complicated mix of private agricultural plots and also collective management of watersheds and watershed councils and hunting regimes, you know, hunting control agreements and so on, and also cross watershed management for things like maintaining water flow and so on, because El Salvador doesn't really, it sort of has a river and a half, you know, it doesn't have really a lot of water resources, so they're important. What these are interesting because they contrast. El Salvador had a really very profound agrarian reform. They redistributed about a fifth of the country into a lot of really complex forms. So those plots are sort of multi-purpose, multi-use agrarian plots rather than sort of monocropping and so on. If you look at, for example, the Bolivian soybean expansion zone or the Mato Grosso expansion zone, which is where most of the soybean is exploding at this moment, those are in sort of classic private property regimes, which is that you own it and that's that. And also the holding size varies tremendously, so that in the South America, you're really looking at holding sizes that go from 5,000 acres to 20,000 acres, whereas you're looking at far smaller things. So in Central America, so that the landscapes have a lot more stability. That is, you can't just sort of say, well, you know, we're going to turn over 1,000 hectares this year into soybean and chow. You have a lot of greater forest dependence for lots of different things in Central America, and that's another thing that's keeping those forests going in the absence of any policies really that support them. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but it seems to me that I'm happy to hear that this is going on. But it seems to me that there's what kind of policies at the macro level would you advocate to actually maybe cooperate with what you see as this really good decentralized thing that's happening? What I understand is a lot of the larger corporate farms in where soybean expansion is like. Volkswagen and huge corporations are owning large tracts of Brazil in that regard. I don't know if that's actually a true thing.
Well, you know, Brazilian, you know, there is a lot. The Brazilians are themselves the world's 10th largest economy, so you don't have to invoke Germany here. Brazil is, you can look at the Bolivian soybean expansion as being essentially an extension of the Brazilian frontier. There's Japanese capital in there, and also in the timber, there's a lot of Indonesian capital that's coming in as well. What I think, in terms of the policies that would support this kind of thing, first of all, I think you're going to have to do a kind of spatial segregation of what goes on. That is, if there are really areas that have suitable soil and suitable landscape, then, you know, maybe it should go into soybeans. But there's plenty of areas where it's going into, and also this is true of livestock, where it's not sustainable. And in those areas, maybe thinking about those areas as areas for carbon offsets or other kinds of environmental offsets might be the way to go. The other thing is providing support for not just saying, okay, carbon offsets as they're currently conceived of under the Kyoto Protocol usually involve basically setting aside an area, maybe a buffer zone of a park or something, that doesn't have any people in it. Well, it makes it sort of vulnerable to any poacher of any kind of resource that you might want. But if you have an area that's inhabited, and this was the argument, of course, made by the rubber tappers and so on, if you have an area that's inhabited, those areas actually become protected. And it's also important to realize that inhabited landscapes like areas that are full of basically what's called in Brazil quilombos or mocambos, they're runaway slave communities that were deep in the forest to evade slaving and still persist as communities into the present day. Those areas actually have traditions of land management, a lot of indigenous knowledge. It's like the rubber tappers who've been in place for a century, and of course indigenous societies that have been in place for often millennia. So you have actually those kinds of things, but also I think there is a kind of dynamic of occupied landscapes that are in agroforestry systems of various kinds that are quite economically dynamic and viable if you work also not just on the landscape, but also on, you know, things like fair trade, free trade, environmental services, that kind of thing.
We have another call here, and I want to thank the last and go on to Belgium, nearby community. Here, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. I'd like to possibly take you in a different direction than just the political aspects of the forest, mm-hmm. and that is being the lumber itself. Now, lumber many times has been fought over in many ways. Take the example of sandalwood in Hawaii. Sandalwood caused a great deal of problems in Hawaii, and they finally ended up just pretty much tearing all of it out that they could so that it wouldn't bring so many people in to destroy their areas. You can go to ebony in southern Africa. It's been brought out of there since time immemorial. The pharaohs used to drag ebony up into their area to use. Lumber itself has been really a moving force. And now, today, we have used up many of these types of lumber, and now they're being grown, shall we say, eco-friendly, which I'm not exactly sure you could actually say, because take the teak forest in southern Asia, Indonesia. They have plantation-grown teak, plantation-grown eucalyptus, but it only puts one species back into what is essentially a mini-species forest, which has problems. And but yet people strive, especially in the West Coast, a lot of people try to use lumber that's grown ecologically friendly, but they miss the aspect that it's really not helping to be ecologically friendly in this. And lumber, you know, Brazil rosewood is not even exported anymore. Brazilian rosewood, which is the best, is not even available anymore. Cuban mahogany, which was just the best mahogany of all, the only real true mahogany, you can't get anymore. And it's very, very valuable material. And I don't know quite where I can put this, but it's a driving force all over the world and has been for years and years and years. Do you deal with how people use the lumber in this way, how they might be able to use more of the urban forest where people grow trees inside cities? But these trees are perfectly good for use for lumber, but nobody really uses them too much.
Well, first of all, there's a couple of things. I think your point about the lumber market in itself is very well taken, and it's important to realize that basically about 80% of the timber that comes out of the Amazon basin is clandestine. So it's one of the least the most problematic sectors you could possibly deal with, and partly that's because of the, as you point to, the incredible value of these lovely veneer woods that all of us crave to have in their our tables and high-end furniture. One of the things, though, that is also important is that there, for a country like Brazil, there's also a lot of national demand, but also that there is increasingly international demand as well. And if you look at, again, the Chinese market for taking out lots of intermediate species that we wouldn't really know that well here, and turning them into floorboarding, inexpensive, relatively inexpensive hardwood floors or medium wood floors, is also a really important dynamic, and it's very active, particularly in the Andean flanks where lots and lots of this timber is going out. The question of reproducing these kinds of multi-species timber forests still remains pretty problematic, and part of the reason is, as you might imagine, is that the time that it takes to plant a multi-species forest and get stuff out at the end is relatively long. The large-term forest plantations like Jarry in the 1970s and 1980s, sooner or later these plantations get terrible disease problems, and that's been particularly true for mahogany in the Brazilian Amazon, where they've been, because it's such a fantastically valuable commodity, people have tried to produce it in sort of plantations and in agricultural settings, and it hasn't worked very well. So part of the problem is that the management for timber species hasn't worked so well. It works a lot better for softwood species, like for pulp, like eucalyptus. So that's what you're sort of seeing, and that's why you're seeing it, is because the market for that and the turnover time is 5 to 8 years versus 30 years, and most rural capitalists won't take that kind of risk over time when they can turn over their money much more quickly. So the other thing is that's happened is the sawmills have gotten a lot more efficient at taking lots more different kinds of wood. So what you have now is a kind of dynamic where many, many more species are being taken and sawn up for things like, you know, various kinds of construction materials, fence materials, and so on. In El Salvador and Central America, of course, you have the phenomenon of living fences that are essentially, you stick the stuff in the ground. Mostly they're the species Gliricidia, but there are many other ones. And those essentially grow into a land demarcation, useful for firewood, useful for fodder. There's a whole slew of kinds of domestic forests that are based on multi-use and multi-species, multiple species, that actually sort of support livelihoods both in small-scale commercial and in domestic uses. But I think you're right to point the question at timber, but one of the things that we're seeing in a lot of the sort of areas of most active deforestation, particularly in the forest conversion areas, the timber was taken out 20 years ago. It's not a story there. It's what now it's just, you know, get the bulldozer in, run it over, pile it up in a row, burn it, and get out the laser levels for the field.
I might also point out to you here that probably something you haven't dealt with is that we in the eastern part of the United States once had a very fabulous forest that went from essentially the Wabash River to the Atlantic Ocean. And it was a huge forest, and there were very nice trees in there. Many of those trees are completely gone, called the chestnut, the butternut, which is now blighted and very badly, elm, all of which, and at the same time, we cleared these forests, very much like we did the Amazon. And we've got a problem that's been long-spanning. I mean, it just didn't happen in Central America. It just didn't happen in South America. It just didn't happen in Southeast Asia. It's happening all over the world at a phenomenal rate that we should slow down. Take the Tonga Forest I think that's actually in Alaska. It could possibly be in British Columbia. But it's being raped now, too, for softwoods, or as you would call it, softwoods. It's actually conifers of various sorts. Well, anyway, you've touched a soft spot in my heart. Thank you. Goodbye. Well,
thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Again, just let me quickly introduce again our guest, Suzanne Hecht. She is professor in the School of Public Affairs at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles. She is also former director of UCLA's Environment and Latin America program. She has now for the past couple of decades been interested in tropical development, its environmental and social impacts, and also alternatives to patterns of destruction that we have talked about. She's here visiting the campus. We'll give a talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Spurlock Museum and the Knight Auditorium. And so anyone who was interested in and around Champaign-Urbana, you should stop by. Questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I don't know if there's anything else that you wanted
well,
to
actually, I thought add. I would respond to some of the comments of your last caller, because one of the things that has happened is that the U.S. right now is one of the is undergoing forest resurgence. It's something people call the forest transition, which is as populations become more urbanized and areas that were marginal for agriculture become less so, become more so as production techniques become more sophisticated outside. You have the abandonment of agricultural lands to forest. And also you have, in many cases, planting of agricultural lands to forest for various reasons. So the U.S. actually right now is one of the big global carbon sinks, because particularly the southeastern part, because of the sort of undermining or the end of the real agricultural efforts there, and also in the Northeast. So while the forest may not be the same, what you can think of is that their functions may be being recovered through these forests, that is, their carbon absorption capacity, their albedo, which is more absorbing than open land, impacts on soils, their impacts on hydrologies, their moderating impacts on microclimates and regional climates. So even though they may not be the perfect perfect forests of our golden age, and one always has to worry about the golden age and when it was, it seems to me that there is this dynamic that it is possible to think of forest trend not just being a negative collapse, but also that there are strong structural transformations that can support forests, and as well as those that destroy them. So it's really important to keep in mind that there is this global dynamic of forest loss and forest recovery.
Mm. I'm interested in going back just to, we're coming down here. We have maybe 5, 6, 7 minutes to this to what's happening in Latin America, places where I think the in making the argument for forest preservation, people said, well, now look, there's a couple things you can do here. Yeah, you can clear cut. And you can go into some sort of monocropping on a massive scale if that's what you want to do. You can grow soybeans, you could raise cattle. But what you also can do is you take the forest and think of it as a multifaceted resource. And by managing it and taking, extracting useful products there, you can maintain the resource. You can make it possible for people to have a living. You could make money for the country. And so that there are these two very different kinds of models. It is the case that the one that says this is a resource that can be, instead of cutting it down and doing something else, we try to maintain it, take out of it what's possible. People can make a living that way. That kind of thing actually is working?
Yes, it actually is. First of all, there are several kinds of extractive reserves based on different kinds of commodities, rubber, natural rubber, and so on. The babassu nut, which provides lauric acid, which is in a lot, it's a wild palm, which the nut provides a lot of things that are used in cosmetics. These are not the world's most lucrative systems, but they have the advantage of stability. They also, provide Brazil nuts and so on. Most of the Brazil nuts you will be buying or coming from these kinds of reserves. So the what they've also done, though, is not it's not just enough to have a kind of production system. You have to have a global marketing system and niche marketing that makes you be able to pay a green premium. So the rise of green markets in these kinds of things is not such a bad idea either. The problem that you get into is the questions of sustainability. We don't really know what this is going to look like for on these sort of soybean lands over time. They're the, running the machinery on them causes a certain amount of compaction. These are oxisols or, and alfasols. They're kind of vulnerable to compaction. So there's some questions about sustainability, perhaps less on the question of the crop itself, but just on soil compaction questions. There are the problems of tropical pests of various kinds. So we don't know how sustainable these are. We know that the earlier eras of tropical soybeans in Bolivia had a long, you know, they weren't really very sustainable. So maybe the technology is catching up or maybe it's not. We don't know. But what we do know is that these other models are sustainable and have been generating fair amounts of income over long periods of time. So particularly the Brazil nuts, the various kinds of latexes, medicinals of various kinds can be seen as one mechanism. But the point is, I think that maybe one should be thinking that there probably need to be several different models of occupation in which soybean happens to be just one. I think it would be very difficult to say to Brazil, hey, so you get 30% of your GDP from agricultural products, stop it right now. I think they'd be quite unlikely to entertain all of that. So the question then starts to be one of agricultural zoning, questions of regulation so that you don't have people moving into areas where it won't be sustainable and where your clearing will be for nothing.
Mm-hmm. Just coming back to a point that you talked about earlier, I guess, I'm thinking back to when the issue of deforestation seemed to be more high-profile concern. And mm-hmm. it seemed that the kind of things that I remember hearing people say was about clearing the forest was, when it's gone, it's gone. That's it, period. No going back. And so I'm not sure that that's exactly true, although if you actually set out to recreate it, it might take you a couple hundred years. I'm interested in the idea, though, that yes, some recovery and some recreation is possible. It may not be exactly the same as it was before, but it also sounds like it's not really the case that when it's gone. Forget
well,
it.
You know, one of my favorite foresters at Berkeley, who just died a few weeks ago, was named Paul Zinke. And one of the things he said to me was, "Susanna, trees grow." And on some level, I, of course, being an arrogant graduate student, said, "Well, Paul, you know, there's all this deforestation; it's never coming back." The reality is that trees grow. Anyone who's tried to do agriculture in the Amazon knows that you're always dealing with this resurgence of brush and so on. And it's one of the big problems that you have. The question really is, how can you use that process of forest recovery to enhance the quality of forest recovery and the quality of those ecosystems? And if you think about things here where people say, well, you know, plant native species so that you can improve wildlife habitat and so on, you can imagine sort of similar things occurring also in these areas that have become abandoned for whatever reason. So the question really is not to say once forests are gone, they're gone for infinity, but rather to sort of think about what are the kinds of ways that you can enhance forest recovery, the kinds of processes that improve forests, and the kinds of policies that might be useful to address this otherwise sort of orphan world that's now in the world of forest resurgence. Mm.
So you've been doing this work since maybe about the mid-70s?
Late 70s. One hates to age oneself. Okay,
so, so would you say that over that time, though, there would have been reason now as opposed to maybe back 20 years to be a little bit more optimistic about this?
Well, part of the problem, I think, is that people don't see these resurgent forests as forests or inhabited areas as forests. Mm-hmm. They see them as anthropogenic areas that have, you know, low diversity and low values. When mm-hmm. actually, when you start to look at them, they're really quite rich and they're quite dynamic. So the question really is, if we want to think forward to the 21st century, what we really have to start to do is look at these matrices, these areas between our high forests, as really sites of future conservation and future ecosystem management, rather than sort of reviling them and sort of saying they have no value, these forests don't count. They count a great deal, and if we start to include them in our calculus, I think what we might find that we need to really rethink conservation strategy for the 21st century.
Well, there we must stop, because we've come here to the end of the program. I do again want to say, though, that our guest this morning, Susanna Hecht, will be giving a talk on this subject this afternoon on the U of I campus, 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. And this is jointly sponsored by the Center for Global Studies and the folks at the Center for Advanced Studies and the UIUC Mega Disasters Research Group. Our guest, Susanna Hecht, is professor in the School of Public Affairs at the University of California, Los Angeles, also former director of UCLA's Environment and Latin America program. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.